he showed violence to was James, as well as others, but James is talked about here, and it says he put him to death with the sword. That is a polite way of saying he removed his head with a sword. He beheaded him. And so, of course, that sent out shockwaves to the whole Christian community, and I'm sure the other people who were in prison, who were imprisoned about the same time that James was imprisoned, were wondering, what happens to me? Am I next? But then Herod, who loved to base what he did on the response of the people, and he's always trying to win points with the Jewish leaders, decided to see what would the death of James, what would be the response of the Jewish people when James was killed. And the response was they liked it. And so he thought, okay, I'm going to win their favor even more. I'm going to arrest and put in prison and put to death their main spokesman and leader named Peter. That's exactly what he did. Put him in prison. Apparently, he knew the story of Peter, because back in Acts chapter 5, if we were to turn back there, we'd read the story about how Peter and other apostles were wonderfully delivered from prison. He knew Peter had escaped earlier, and so he thought to himself, I'm never going to let that happen again. And so he assigns four squads of soldiers. The word literally is quaternions. There were four groups of four Roman soldiers assigned just to Peter to make sure he didn't escape. Probably they were assigned to like six-hour shifts. Four men every 6 hours changed shifts. Two of them would be inside the prison, each of them chained to Peter. Two of them would be outside the prison cell, outside the door, making sure Peter didn't get out and making sure no one came in to rescue him. I think it's safe to say this was a maximum security Roman environment, Roman prison. It all looked hopeless. And the writing was already on the wall. This is going to happen to Peter. It happened to James, and Peter's next. So how did the church respond? We're told in verse 5, which I think is a pivotal part of the story. So Peter was kept in prison, but prayer for him was being made fervently by the church of God. They weren't just praying. The Bible's very specific here. They were praying fervently. The word fervently is related to a medical term which referred to the stretching of a muscle of the body as tight as it can get. It has the idea of intensity. This fervent praying is the word that's used to describe what Jesus experienced in the Garden of Gethsemane when he poured out his heart to the Father and prayed fervently that the cup would pass from him. This is an intense word. It's not just passive praying. It's very active, intense praying. And that's how the church responded. And when you think about it, prayer was about all they could do. Because they really couldn't go and convince Herod to change his mind. They knew that. They knew they couldn't go to the prison and somehow break in and release Peter. So all they could do was pray. All they could do was pray. Sometimes we say that as if it's like, that's a lower thing on the ladder of priorities. Friends, I think it's important to remember that's the most powerful thing they could do. That's the most significant thing they could do. And they did it. They prayed. We're never told exactly what they prayed. But what would you have prayed if you had been the church in Jerusalem on that day? I think it's pretty clear they would have prayed for Peter's release. They knew what had happened to James, and they would pray, Lord, please somehow deliver Peter. I think they probably prayed for peace for Peter. And I think we see that in in verse 6. On the very night when Herod was about to bring him forward, Peter was sleeping between two soldiers bound with two chains. And guards in front of the door were watching over the prison. We're told that Peter was arrested, but Herod was going to wait till after the Passover. It speaks of the unleavened bread. The Passover was a one-day celebration. The Feast of Unleavened Bread followed the Passover immediately, so it was an eight-day total Jewish festival. And Herod didn't want to kill Peter then. I think there's a part of him that would have liked to have done that right away, but he wanted to wait until after the festival was over so he had the full attention of the Jewish leaders. And so here Peter is in prison waiting for up to 8 days, waiting for the Passover to end, because then Herod was going to bring him out before the people, make sure he had a public hearing, and then find a way to behead him as well. That's clearly his path and his plan. But what is Peter doing on the night before his supposed execution? He's sleeping. Chained to two smelly Roman guards. He's sleeping. In a horrible Roman prison cell, dungeon. Much worse than you've ever envisioned it to be. And he was sleeping, and it's clear as we continue the story, he was sleeping soundly. The angel could hardly wake him up. God is at work here in this situation. He had peace, it seems very clear. And the story continues, though, as he was sleeping in verse 7, it says, "And an angel of the Lord suddenly appeared, and a light shone in the cell, and he struck Peter's side and woke him up, saying, 'Get up quickly,' and his chains fell off his hands." What an amazing answer to prayer. The people are praying like crazy. God somehow deliver him, and God says, okay. Sends his angel. The angel shows up in the prison, and it says there's light in the prison. But that didn't wake Peter up. And it didn't wake up the guards either. They apparently slept through this whole thing or were knocked unconscious. I don't know what God did to them, but they didn't get anything. They had no idea any of this was going on. So the angel comes, bright light, and then he starts talking to Peter and gives him instructions of what to do. And guards didn't hear anything, didn't see anything. To wake up Peter, just talking to him wasn't enough. It says very clearly he had to kind of bop him on the side like, "Peter." And then Peter stands up and the chains fell off of him. Chinkle, 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 chinkle. The guards are still out of commission, comatose of some kind. And then they get up, and Peter, you can just tell he's kind of groggy. I mean, he was sleeping really well. He has to wake up, and the angel kind of tells him what to do, and he puts on his cloak, and they walk out of the prison. They walk by the first set of guards. They walk by the second set of guards. They get out to this outer area, and the gate opens by itself. That was long before the days of electric eyes. God's doing something amazing here. The chains fell off his hand. The angel said to him, "Gird yourself and put on your sandals," and he did so, and he said to him, "Wrap your cloak around you and follow me," and he went out and followed, and he did not know that what was being done by the angel was real, but thought he was seeing a vision. When they had passed the first and second guard, they came to the iron gate that leads into the city, which opened for them by itself, and they went out and went along one street, and immediately the angel departed from it. When Peter came to himself, he said, "Now I know for sure that the Lord has sent his angel and rescued me from the hand of Herod and from all that the Jewish people were expecting." It isn't until verse 11 that Peter comes to himself. It's then he realizes, hey, this isn't a vision, this isn't a dream, this is really happening. I'm out of the prison, I'm standing on this street. And he knew what God had done. He was really free. And what did he do next? Right away, he knew where he needed to go, verse 12. And when he realized this, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, who was also called Mark, where many were gathered together and were praying. When he knocked at the door of the gate, a servant girl named Rhoda came to answer. When she recognized Peter's voice, because of her joy, she did not open the gate, but ran in and announced that Peter was standing in front of the gate. They said to her, "You are out of your mind." But she kept insisting that it was so. They kept saying, "It is his angel." But Peter continued knocking, and when they had opened the door, they saw him and were amazed. But motioning to them with his hand to be silent, he described to them how the Lord had led him out of the prison, and he said, "Report these things to James and the brethren." Then he left and went to another place. Peter went to Mary's house. He knew, obviously, that is where people would gather to pray for him. The implication is he'd been there himself. Because when he got there and began knocking, Rhoda, the servant girl, knew him well enough to even recognize his voice. But it's interesting, she got so excited, it says she was so filled with joy that she didn't open the door. She ran back to the prayer meeting and announced that Peter was standing outside the door, and they didn't believe it. They said, "You're crazy. You're out of your mind." She said, "No, I'm not." And she gave more reasoning, and she explained that that's who it was. And then they said, "Well, if it is somebody, it's like an angel." We don't know exactly what they had in mind here. It seems like their theology in this area was a little bit unsettling. They may have thought it was somehow his guardian angel coming to represent him. The word actually translated angel here is the word pneuma. It could be translated spirit. They may have been saying it's his spirit out here, thinking, well, maybe he's dead, and now his spirit's coming to talk to us. I don't know. It's really bizarre what they may have been thinking. But we do know this. They didn't think it was Peter. They didn't believe the answer to their prayer was actually there. But finally, they went back because Peter kept knocking. I think if you were Peter, you would have kept knocking too, because you're a fugitive. And you know that you've just escaped from prison, and you know that it won't take long until soldiers will be all over the city looking for this fugitive, and you're standing out on the street, and your friends won't even let you in. You better get out of the street. So he keeps knocking, and they finally came, and they opened the door. And they were amazed. They were amazed at the answer to their own prayer. But Peter was standing there, and you could tell they kind of got excited because it says Peter had to motion with his hand like, "Be quiet. Don't wake up the neighbors. Don't tell everybody I'm here." He was still a fugitive. But then he took time to tell them what had happened. He told them a great deal in great detail how God had used this angel to wonderfully deliver him from this prison. And I'm sure they were just amazed at the account that Peter gave them. But then it says, he says at the end of verse 17, he didn't just tell them the account of what happened. He said this, "Report these things to James and the brethren." Then he left and went to another place. He knew he had to get out of there. He knew he was jeopardizing all of their lives by even being there, and so he left and went and hid somewhere else. But before he did that, he said, "Report these things to James." Now, earlier we had just read about James being killed. He's not talking about that James. He's talking about a different James. He's talking about James, his half-brother, who did not even become a follower of Christ until after the resurrection. He's talking about James, the man who later would write the book of James. He's talking about James, who in chapter 15 becomes very clearly the leader of the church in Jerusalem. He wants the leader of the church in Jerusalem, his half-brother, to know what God had done in answer to prayer. He wanted him and the brethren, the other Christians in the town, to know that God was still on the move and God was still guiding and protecting his church and that God was at work. It was a message of hope and encouragement. And then he left. But the story continues. Verse 18. Now when day had come, there was no small disturbance among the soldiers as to what could have become of Peter. When Herod had searched for him and had not found him, he examined the guards and had ordered that they be led away to execution. Then he went down from Judea to Caesarea and was spending time there. The next day, they get up in the morning, and the two soldiers who were next to Peter, who were chained to Peter, look toward where Peter should have been, and he's not there. And the guard, and they, I'm sure, woke, if they needed to, wake up the guards outside and told them the same thing, and there begins to be a panic. I think probably the classic understatement is in verse 18 when it says there was no small disturbance among the soldiers because they knew what was at stake. They were scared to death because Roman law worked this way. If you were to guard a prisoner and he escaped under your watch, you would then face the punishment he would most certainly have received. So if he was going to receive a horrible beating, you would receive that horrible beating. If he was going to be executed, you would be executed. And so when Herod examined these men and ordered them to be led away, examined the soldiers and interviewed them, and it says he led them away. He was leading them away to be executed. There are at least four men, perhaps 16, who had their heads removed. And it's interesting then that Herod, after doing that, he just left. Made a two-day journey to the coast, to the Mediterranean Sea, to Caesarea Maritime, that beautiful city where Roman leaders liked to stay because it was so beautiful and the climate was nicer and all those different things. Besides that, he didn't want to face the infamy of having lost this prisoner, this prized prisoner in Jerusalem. And then we think the story's over. It's not. Verse 20, now he was very angry with the people of Tyre and Sidon. He was grumpy about what took place in Jerusalem. He was unhappy about that. Now he's angry about this. Tyre and Sidon were two port cities just north of Caesarea. But with one accord they came to him, and having won over Blastus, the king's chamberlain, they were asking for peace because their country was fed by the king's country. On an appointed day, Herod, having put on his royal apparel, took his seat on the rostrum and began delivering an address to them, and the people kept crying out, "The voice of a god and not of a man." And immediately, an angel of the Lord struck him because he did not give God the glory, and he was eaten by worms and died. But the word of the Lord continued to grow and to be multiplied. The people cried, "The voice of a god and not a man." And Herod liked that. I thought to himself, yeah, I'm pretty special. Look what I've done. And immediately, he was struck with something. It ended up being worms. It's very interesting. Josephus, the first century historian, gives a very detailed account of what took place, even more than the book of Acts gives us through the writing of Luke. Josephus tells us that it was immediate. He was up, he was in this amphitheater, he was up there, and he gave, you know, people were giving him these acclaims, the voice of a god and not a man, and all of a sudden, because he accepted that kind of input, he actually doubled over in pain and had to be carried out of the amphitheater. And 5 days later, he died. Very interesting if you think of this whole story. What's happening at the beginning of the story? Herod is trying to destroy the church of Jesus Christ. He's trying to stop the plan of God. What happens at the end of the story? Herod is destroyed by God so that God's plan can move forward, so that the church of Jesus Christ will not be hindered by Herod. It's an amazing contrast. Jesus had promised to Peter these words, "I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it." And Jesus is proving here the validity of those words. The church was still marching on. The word of the Lord, verse 24, continued to grow and be multiplied. And you see that as you continue to read the rest of the book of Acts. There are so many amazing truths found in this story. It happens to be one of my very favorite stories in the whole Bible. I hope it becomes one of yours. But as you know, this month we've really been focusing on the importance of prayer, and so I'd like to draw just three truths about prayer found in this passage. And I think they're very important, and I think they'll be of help to all of us. So this is the first one. This story does not guarantee that when prayer is involved, there will always be a happy ending. There are those who say that in this life, every prayer should result in a happy ending. It's just not true. The text makes that clear from the very beginning. It was a happy ending for Peter, but it wasn't a happy ending for John. Now, we're never told in this passage specifically that the church of Jesus Christ, I said for John, for James, we are never told specifically that the church of Jesus Christ in Jerusalem prayed for James. But I have to believe that they did. In Acts 2:42, we're told of several characteristics of the church, of the early church in Jerusalem. There were a number of things that they devoted themselves to, but one of the things they devoted themselves to was prayer. And I promise you, if you were a friend of James, if you were a friend of any of the other people who were arrested, you would have been praying. And yet James was killed by the sword. We can't help but wrestle with that tension. Why? Why was James killed by the sword? He was one of the three disciples that Jesus would take off by themselves, he, Peter, James, and John, and he would mentor them in a special way for what looked to be the future of the church. And very early in the years of the church, James is taken off the scene. People were praying for him, and he was beheaded. People were praying for the other people. It wasn't just James that was arrested. It wasn't just Peter that was arrested. It says a number of people were arrested. A number of Christians were arrested. What about them? Peter was set free from prison. They weren't. They were being abused by Herod in prison. What about them? If you were a family member, can you imagine the struggle of trying to deal with that? You hear the story of Peter. Maybe you were part of praying for Peter, but your loved one, James, was still dead. How do you process that? I think we have to understand there's a measure of mystery and tension in life that we don't fully put together. If you try to put all of that together in your mind, you'll fail because it doesn't always make sense from our perspective. Just because we pray, it is not a guarantee that what will happen is what we want to happen. Somehow in this whole process, God, who is sovereign, will bring ultimate good out of even the most horrible things in life. And I don't know how to exactly process that, and I don't know exactly how to reconcile all that. I just know it's true. And I just want to encourage you, if some of you have been praying for a situation or have prayed for a situation in the past and it didn't come out like you had hoped it would, don't be so hard on yourself. There's a point at where we have to trust a God who is still good and in control and sovereign. He has an ultimate plan for good. You know, I don't think the death of James made sense to anybody in that church in Jerusalem. I don't think it made sense to anybody. But what I love about it is they didn't run from God, they ran to God. And when Peter was put in a similar situation, they prayed. They were passionate about prayer. So let me just challenge you, are you passionate about prayer? Secondly, let me just remind you of the first point. This story does not guarantee that when prayer is involved, there is always a happy ending. Sometimes there is, but not always. And may I add, not yet. Because there is a coming day where God's going to make all of this stuff right. And that's one of the greatest joys we have as a Christian, because there's so many things in this life that do not make sense. Not yet. But secondly, sometimes God surprises us with his answers. Sometimes God responds in ways that we actually don't expect. I love this story because the church was praying for Peter's response, release. But they really didn't think it was going to happen, did they? If they really thought it was going to happen when Peter was knocking at the front door, they'd have been saying, oh yeah, answer to my prayer. But they didn't. They were praying for Peter's release, knowing God could really do that, really asking for that, really wanting that. But when it happened, they didn't believe it. They said to Rhoda, you're out of your mind. It's an angel or it's a spirit or who knows what it is, but it's not Peter. And all the while, the answer to their prayer was knocking at the front door just a few feet away. You know, some people say, well, you have to have all kinds of faith for your prayer to come true. I want to tell you, you don't need all kinds of faith. You just need a teeny little bit. And I hope that encourages you, because sometimes people put a big guilt trip on you like it's your fault that your prayer has not been answered because your faith isn't quite right. I'm telling you, their faith wasn't altogether, but God answered their prayer and they were surprised by his answer. Don't you love it when God does that? You pray for something, and you're thinking, well, I know God can do it, but I don't know if he's going to do it. And then God does it, you go, whoa, that is so great. Some of you could tell me stories of when that has happened. And God showed up in a powerful way, and he surprised you with the answer. And I say, enjoy the surprise. But thirdly, and perhaps most importantly, prayer unleashes the power of God. I don't know exactly how it works, because God is always sovereign. He will always accomplish his plan, but our prayers are part of that. Prayer changes things. Prayer makes a difference. We're called to pray. We're shown examples of prayer by Jesus and the Apostle Paul and Moses, and the list goes on and on. Prayer matters. Verse 5 again, so Peter was kept in prison, but prayer for him was being made fervently by the church of God. You know, some people read this story and they say, well, Peter would have been delivered anyway. Wait a minute, how would we know that? I don't think we should assume that at all. Yeah, I know Jesus at the end of John told Peter, you're going to live to be an old man, but maybe Peter was thinking, I think I'm getting old. I don't think we should assume at all that this would have happened exactly this way if the Church of Jesus Christ had not been praying. I think we should assume it wouldn't. Prayer unleashes the power of God. Do you believe that? Do you believe that enough to actually pray? Again, I promise you, if you're in a crisis, you will do that. You will respond in prayer, and you will respond with urgency. But God wants us to pray not just in times of crisis. He wants us to always pray because we desperately need God's power to show up in our lives. So let me ask you, do you pray? If God were to evaluate your prayer life these last 2 weeks, would he say, that is a person who prays fervently, passionately? It's what's said about the church in Jerusalem. And I think that's an important thing to ask about us just as a church as a whole, where the individuals come together. If God were to look at our church, would he, describing the Hastings Berean Bible Church, would he say, those are people who pray fervently? My guess is that we have room to grow in that area. I know I do personally. My guess is you do. I think corporately we have room to grow in this area. But I was just thinking to myself, what would happen? What would happen if we would all fervently pray this next year at least 5 minutes a day for the needs and the issues related to this local church, for the leaders, for our unity, for God to do powerful and wonderful things? What would happen if everyone in this room for this next year would pray 10 minutes, 5 to 10 minutes a day for this church? What would happen? You know, I don't know what would happen, but I sure would like to find out. Because power, the power of God is unleashed by prayer. And sometimes I've thought to myself, Paul, if you're not praying, who in the world do you think you are? As if I can fix things? Are you kidding me? When I first went into the ministry, I thought I could fix things. I gave that up in the first 6 months. I tried to fix some stuff. I couldn't fix anything. But when God shows up in response to prayer, when he shows up with his power, it's amazing what he does in the lives of people. Today, I just want to encourage us to be fervent prayers. Not just prayers, not just praying, I think as Matthew mentioned, just praying at meals or praying at bedtime. That's all good. Please keep that up. But finding ways to strengthen our prayers. And as we wrap up the service today, we're going to pray in a special way for someone who needs our fervent prayers. Many of you know his name. His name is Nick Herringer. We're going to show a video that tells a little bit of Nick's story. And then after that, we're going to invite Nick and his family to come forward, and we're going to pray for them during this time. This is just one example of the need for fervent prayer.